Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Constance Adler, whose new novel is Sight Unseen. It is such a pleasure to welcome Constance Adler back to The Reading Life. Last time, we talked about her wonderful memoir, My Bayou, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover. And today, we're celebrating her first novel, Sight Unseen. Constance's work has appeared in the Oxford American, the Utney Reader, Garden and Gun, the Podunk Review, among many other publications. And she has taught creative writing at the Newcomb College Institute. Constance, welcome back.
Thank you, Susan. It is, as always, a pleasure to see you.
It is a pleasure to see you and your book in hand. Now, one of the things that I most remember from our first conversation is that you moved to New Orleans because you had a dream that said if you moved to New Orleans, you thought you could be a really interesting writer. Mm-hmm. So, how and why did you think that?
Well, all right. I need to correct the record on that.
Okay.
So the woman in the dream... No, not, you got it right. I didn't include this information when I first wrote about it.
Oh, good.
So this is breaking news.
All right.
What actually happened in that dream is that woman told me I would be coming to New Orleans to write my novel. And I scoffed at her in my dream. And it was so unnerving, I couldn't even write it when I put it into a story. I had to change. I just had to leave out the part about the novel. So now I can put it in. Now I can go on record.
It was too terrifying to contemplate.
It was terrifying to contemplate, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I thought she couldn't be trusted. But she was right.
Well, it cracks me up, sort of, because your first book had the subtitle, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still writing about New Orleans through the eyes of a lover in this book, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I also wanted to pursue in this novel, just in general, how looking at something changes it. Looking at something mm-hmm. helps to create it. And looking at something with love through the eyes of a lover really manifests that beauty in the thing that you see. And so I think so much of what I've written, both in my first book and my second book, I've created by looking at it, by seeing it, by choosing to see it a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very active sort of creative choice to look with love.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So tell us about the protagonist of this novel, Claire and Simon, and their lives in New Orleans.
So there are three principal characters in the story. Claire, who's a photographer, and her husband, Simon, who runs a plant nursery out of their backyard. And their dog, Hank, who is a 100-pound Labrador. He's the middleman, the bridge between the two humans. I've set the book to start on May 8th, the night of May 8th, 1995, which was, for those of us who were around back then, was a huge flood
mm-hmm.
that really engulfed the city. And it wasn't as infamous as Hurricane Katrina, but I treat it as sort of a dress rehearsal for what came 10 years later.
Yep.
And they have that in their lives. They have to sort of cope with that. And in addition to that, they are grappling with a lot of difficulties in their marriage that they have to figure out. The main one is they have conflicting plans or desires around parenthood. And so they do make some attempts to have a family, which fail. And then there's another hurricane threat 6 months later. And so much of the book is really concerned with their learning how to survive the onslaught from outside through weather and mm-hmm. water, and the fractures from within. They have to learn how to survive, both literally and figuratively. And towards the end of the book, what I hope is that they have acquired some good survival skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, it ends on this kind of perfect grace note. So I think they have.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm glad to hear you say that.
So one of the things about this book is, you know, how we see things, how all different kinds of people see things. Also lurkers and spies and things like that. But there are literal visions, there are spiritual visions, there are hilarious ripping away of the veil moments, you know what I mean? And it's also about the way in which sometimes we don't see right in front of us.
Yes, that's true. And I think part of going back to this issue of survival is involves the main character is really the locus for this concept of seeing and vision, is learning how to sharpen her sight and how to look without sort of letting her own blind spots get in the way. And that's really hard for her. And I think her process as a photographer helps to look more deeply and more honestly at what she's seeing and to not get sidetracked by her own blind spots.
Now, one of the things that I love is the way you use that terrific generative quality of New Orleans. You know, we have a storm, we have wreckage all over the place, we have things growing right away, you know, practically overnight. And you can see that wild jungle quality of the landscape, which is very beautiful. So read us a little passage that kind of describes that.
Okay. So this is this comes towards the end of the book when Claire has she's gone through a lot. And something that happens frequently in the story is that she keeps returning to the garden as a place to sort of calm herself and make sense of things. And the garden also, you know, apropos of what you were just asking me about, all of the lush growth, it's where this life is happening for her. And it's where she can see things. It's like it helps her understand what's going on. Claire saw the garden inhale, subtly expanding and distorting the physical features, the shapes of the philodendron, the caladium, the trunk of Sally the crepe myrtle tree warped slightly, and then shrank back in the opposite direction for the exhale. The line of her sight sank back to a diminishing point in the center, as if the great bellows of the earth had shown itself to her just now. As Claire stood there watching the mud and all the things growing in it, the garden responded to the rise and fall of her chest by falling into the same rhythm. She blinked, shook herself, and then returned to this delicate, synchronized movement. Together, she and the garden aligned again. She had found something extraordinary with her eyes. It was an opening that showed a channel between her body and the living world around her. On this night, Claire reached out her hands toward the garden and opened them to the air, facing the grass and trees, the intoxicating jasmine. She willed her eyes to focus, pushing past the surface, delving deeper into what her eyes could see. Quickly, the movement in all things around her came to the surface of her palms. It was a faint pulse. Yet when she expanded her lungs with this beat, she felt the animal richness of the night air against her skin, a steady rhythm. It was real. The garden and the night and Claire all formed the same living body at once, breathing together. Claire cherished this rediscovery, summoned from her child's mind. This time she could embrace it. This time she would tell no one.
Oh, I love the nighttime garden. It's such a rich metaphor. There are whole books on how to have a nighttime garden.
Oh,
you know?
Wow. Okay.
So, now, are you a gardener yourself?
I am. I have a very tiny garden. And this is another thing that I love about New Orleans is like even with a very small garden, you can accomplish a lot. A little plot of land can produce so much. And it's astonishing to me how much grows all around me. And I've planted several trees on my small property over the past 20 years that I've lived there. And it's such a pleasure to see how well these trees are doing, how tall they've become, and to know I put them there. I got them going. I got them started. It's really, it gives me a great sense of accomplishment, almost more than writing a book. You know?
And a little less work.
Yeah, that's true. I just have to, you know, water them during droughts. That's all I really have to do.
Now, you aren't actually a photographer.
I am a little bit of a photographer, not serious, not a real one, no.
But you turned to a photographer for help with this book.
I did. My friend Cheryl Gerber read my manuscript for me, and I was expecting her to like have all sorts of pointers, and she read it, and she called me and said she wanted to talk to me, and I said, okay, and so we got together, and she said, oh, I loved it. And I said, okay, but how about the photography part? She said, oh, that was fine. It was all fine. And then she wanted to talk about the rest of what was going on in the book. She's a wonderful reader, not just a great photographer.
Yeah, she reads a lot.
She has a lot of really interesting things to say about books and stories. Mm-hmm. So she was a good help that way as well, not just with the photography.
Oh, every one of her photographs tells a story, an incredible story.
I did take a couple of photography workshops, actually, to try to learn what I'm doing. And I did buy an old Pentax K1000 camera to work with. And I was working with black and white film just to see what would come out. It's very difficult, those old cameras.
Mm-hmm.
They really are.
But they're comparatively beautiful.
I loved the mechanical sort of nature of being with the photo and being with the camera and all these different things you have to count on. It's nothing is automatic, you know.
Well, it's also a way to put something between yourself and the world.
Yes.
You know, as well as engage with the world.
Right. And that's something that Claire learns in the course of her progress as a photographer, is that having this camera helps her to be more vulnerable because she has something to hide behind. And that helps her photography. That helps her mm-hmm. get a better photo.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Constance Adler, whose new book is Sight Unseen. Now, there are two incredibly memorable dogs in this book. There's Arthur mm-hmm. and there's Hank.
Mm-hmm.
So you've obviously watched dogs with a lot of care and attention. So what is it like writing a dog character?
My mission as a writer is to give the dog characters the same quality of attention and writing as I would to the human characters.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't like in other, you know, readings that I've seen with dog characters is that they become sort of like the wallpaper of the book or the set dressing. First of all, when you're organizing a book, everything has to go toward some purpose. It has to be there for some reason. It has to contribute toward the forward movement of the story and reaching its end. And so I really put Hank into this story. He's one of the main dog characters because he has to function in a way that he has to produce something for the story that the human characters can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he does bring to the story is this really strong sort of ground level consciousness that is not aware of itself, but is very powerful and strong,
yeah.
Like a force of nature, like what's growing in the garden. And he also serves the humans. As we know, those of us who love dogs know, our dogs serve us. They live to serve mm-hmm. us. They, you know, and I think that he serves these characters by being this very absorbent and completely non-judgmental and completely open entity to hold all of the unspoken, rejected parts of themselves that they can't look at or talk about. And he becomes the receptacle to hold all of that, which he does willingly. I believe dogs volunteer for this service.
Oh, I do too.
So that's what he does for these characters.
I loved him. Weren't you sad to say goodbye to Hank?
Mm-hmm. He's still living in the back of my mind.
Well, he is a lovely, lovely creature. And I love that dogs, they're both miracle dogs, Arthur uh-huh. and Hank.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah, they rise from the dead.
Now, all the characters are drawn with such love and care. One whole chapter is devoted to Claire's grandmother cleaning a chicken.
Yes.
And it's such a wonderful chapter. And it was published separately in a literary journal. So talk about writing that chapter and talk about the grandmothers in this book who are so unforgettable.
Well, they are based on my grandmothers. I have stretched the facts and the history a little bit, mm-hmm. but those are my grandmothers, Nona and Clara, who is the namesake for Claire. My Italian grandmother is this Nona. Again, a very strong sort of enduring consciousness that is constantly informing her. Even long after Nona is dead, she is still speaking to Claire. Claire can still hear her grandmother speaking to her. And it's as if she internalized this entity who is very much a survivor. She knows how to keep body and soul together. And one sense is that Claire is relying on the wisdom of this old woman to guide her toward a better grip on her own survival, you know. And I love Nona. She came up in a writing exercise that I was doing in a workshop, and I can't remember what the prompt was, but I just began writing this scene of this grandmother tearing apart a chicken, because my own grandmother would sit at the kitchen table with my grandmother while she pulled apart a chicken to make soup. And these images are so solid and real in my memory. And that's what makes a good story, a good character. Yeah. You have to start with something that you know you've seen.
Were you a vegetarian even then?
I was not. I became a vegetarian later, but I knew Claire would want to be a vegetarian
away. Did you help with the chicken at the time?
I couldn't touch it in its raw state. I couldn't. See, but that's what I loved about my grandmother. She was fearless. She would go at any task.
Yeah.
She would go at any task.
Mine was mostly a baker, which I wish I'd inherited more skill from, you know. Now, this is a story about a woman's quest to live a passionate and creative life, to find her passion in a way, and about how having children might or might not figure into that life. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that as a choice that all women have to make.
Well, I think that the decision to have a child, like a lot of creative choices, in order to make it well, I think it almost always ends up being made in a really spontaneous way, in a really almost unconscious way. I think that if it becomes too freighted with symbolism, then it founders. It falls apart. And I think that carries through to one's choices as an artist. You have to really work with what arises spontaneously. If you are trying too hard, you kind of cut off your own creativity. You cut off the creation. And I think in that sense, those two things are parallel. I don't have a child, so I can't really speak knowledgeably about that. But it's what I've always imagined is true about the choice to have a child.
But you have a dog.
I do have a dog. That's true.
Oh, a lovely dog.
Oh, thank you.
Now, it occurs to me that if you were beginning this novel today, if you were setting this novel in contemporary times, not 1995, that choice of whether or not to have a child would have a whole different layer that would have to go with it and have to be addressed.
You mean because of the current political situation? Yes. Yeah, that's true. It's a much more terrifying prospect now.
But it was pretty terrifying then. That's one of the things that struck me. Because even taking away that layer of politics that we're living with now, and even the things that are happening in the novel, it is so streamlined and personal. It's almost the way it should be.
And you're saying now it's far more.
If you were going to start this book right now, you wouldn't set it in 1995.
If I were setting it now, you're right. This character would have to be considering, oh my God, what if I do have a miscarriage and I need help? Will I get it? And yes, that's what I meant when I said it's a much more terrifying choice now. That's true. I agree with you. The choice should be streamlined, should be pure, should be free of those kinds of concerns. We shouldn't, shoulda, woulda, coulda. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's so hard to talk about it because there are all these things happening out there beyond our control, but impact our bodies and the choices that women make. I mean, that choice, I'm past the age where I could make that choice now, but I'm very sensitive to what younger women must be going through mm-hmm. now in these choices. And also, frankly, I think a lot of women, and this is another complication added to the choice, I'm not sure how many people want to bring a child into this world.
That's true.
It's becoming a very frightening world, more so than usual. I mean,
yeah. It wasn't quite as frightening in 1995.
It wasn't. That's what I was going to say. I mean, life is always challenging, fraught with challenges, just inherent in the nature of getting on with life. There are all going to be all kinds of things that happen, but our lives, women's bodies, have been weighed down by this current atmosphere that
mm-hmm.
makes
so different.
A thousand times harder.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Constance Adler, whose new book is Sight Unseen. How did you feel when you finished this book? What did this do for you? There's a difference in writing a memoir and writing a novel.
Yes, there is. I am very relieved and grateful that I was able to complete this, that it came to a natural end. I never saw myself as a novelist. Really, I have been a journalist for most of my life.
Right.
And I have written a great deal of memoir and creative nonfiction. So to embark on the task of writing a novel was a personal challenge. I felt that I needed to finish, to do it. It's something I think that most writers go through. It's like the real, quote unquote, real writers are the novelists. And you can't call yourself a real writer until you have written that novel. And so I really pushed myself hard to finish this. I was very determined not...
Constance Adler, real writer.
Well, I was very determined not to let this go. I certainly contemplated just letting it go many mm-hmm. times. It took a long time for me to finish it. I started it. I mean, I wrote the first chapter as a short story almost 20 years ago. And I would pick it up and drop it and pick it up and drop it. I wrote two other books in between, you know, during the course of that past mm-hmm. 20 years. So I've been busy, but not finishing this until now. It feels wonderful. I'm so glad.
What was it that got you back to finishing it?
I couldn't let it go. I remember distinctly having this very strong image of Claire and Simon standing in their garden at night. And that image of them wouldn't go away.
Mm.
It was very strong and it just wouldn't go away. Perhaps it haunted me, I'm not sure, but they wouldn't disappear. Usually when
give us life.
Or just don't forget us.
Yeah.
I think that was the message I was getting. Like, we are still here. Don't forget us. You can come back. The novel was pretty nice to me. During the course of my writing it. Yeah, no, it was. It wouldn't let me go, but it wasn't nagging me, you know. It was being mm-hmm. nice to me, just sort of every so often gently letting me know, we're still here, we're waiting for you to come back and finish. And so I would go back and work on it some more.
Well, thank God.
Yeah, I'm really lucky I had such a nice novel.
We'll see what the next one's like.
Yeah.
Be careful not to tempt
right.
fate. We've been talking with Constance Adler, whose new novel is Sight Unseen. You can meet her Thursday, January 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Constance, congratulations, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan. This means a lot to me. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Aaron Roven presents The Little Bee Tree at a Mardi Gras Storytime Saturday, January 25th at 11 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. The Carol Barnett Boudreaux 65 Great Writers Series presents Pulitzer Prize winner Marilyn Robinson, author of Housekeeping, Gilead, Home, Lila, and Jack, Tuesday, January 28th at 6 at a public lecture, book signing, and reception to follow at the Lake Theater, Lake Residence Hall, Tulane University. Laura Buchwald discusses her novel Coat Check Girl with Norman Woolworth and signs books Tuesday, January 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Constance Adler discusses her novel Sight Unseen with Nicole Iden and signs books Thursday, January 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bernadette Atuhaini discusses and signs Plundered, How Racist Policies Undermine Black Home Ownership in America, Thursday, January 30th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Coming up February 1st, Blue Cypress Books presents A Celebration of Black Romance Writers, featuring Darby Bayham, Farah Roshan, A.H. Cunningham, and Scarlett Miller, Saturday, February 1st at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. And the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will sponsor a warehouse book sale on Saturday, February 8th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The sale will be held in the hallway directly off the lobby at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Boxes of books will include cookbooks, children's books, and regular fiction. Boxes are labeled as to what they contain, but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. Payment may be made using cash or credit card, and for more info, please contact the Friends at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.